Howdy folks, welcome back to the New Sprint Commando. My name is Ed Moore, I'm your host. Today we are considering a Pacific Tuesday. All the books published by Pacific Comics in June 1983. Four books we're looking at today. Starting off with Bernie Wrightson, Master of the Macabre. But even before that, if you want to get in touch, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter as Teal Productions. News P Commando has a Twitter page as well. Teal Productions now has a Blue Sky page, so you can leave comments there. IamIndieMan@gmail.com is the email address. And the website, comicbooknoise.com/TNC, Tango November Charlie the Letters. Now the cover we're looking at was penciled and inked by Bernie Wrightson, colored by Steve Olaf, and lettered by William Stout. And basically the cover is of a portion of a face, looks like male, from just below the nose to just above the eyebrows. Kind of a very scary looking set of eyes. The mouth is seemingly covered by something. And reflecting back on the stories, I'm not sure which, if any, of these stories that would have been an image of. Maybe the middle story? Yeah, I'm not really sure. But we open it up. Inside front cover is a letter from Bruce Jones. Kind of an editor's letter, I guess, although he is more than the editor. He is a packager. This particular issue, he didn't, or did he? Let's see. He didn't write any of the stories. These are all written by Bernie Wrightson. So, but Bruce Jones with a word. And it's a lengthy word, so if you know someone is really interested, look up the book and check out the word. Now, all three of these stories have been previously printed somewhere else. So this is a repackaging of stories, all by Bernie, scripted, penciled, and inked, except the third one. I'll get into it here momentarily. Well, a couple momentarilies. The difference being that from what I can tell, now I don't have these books that these stories were originally printed in. They are copies or issues of Eerie and Creepy from the middle 70s, which anybody that is into collecting knows that those are a little on the pricier side. Plus, they're not necessarily my forte, so there's no reason for me to collect them just to look at these short, you know, 8, 10, 12 page stories that might have been in it. But my understanding of Creepy and Eerie is that these were black and white stories. Here, in this reproduction for Master of the Macabre from Pacific, they're in color. All the colors being by Mr. Steve Olaf for all three stories. So the first one we open up, it is penciled and inked by Bernie Wrightson, colored by Steve Olaf, and lettered by William Stout. Or I'm sorry, that's the cover. Scripts, pencils, and inks by Bernie Wrightson, and colors by Steve Olaf for the first story, entitled Muck Monster. And to me, basically, this is a story about a doctor, a creator, and the consciousness that he creates. Not so much the monster. It is kind of a take on Frankenstein, or Frankenstein, depending on, you know, whether or not you've seen the movie. This originally showed up in Eerie number 68 from 1975. So that was, what, 8 years prior to this reprinting. It's a quick 7-page story. Scientist in his laboratory trying to create a patchwork monster, much as Dr. Frankenstein and his creation, his monster. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. The doctor's not quite sure why, but he does find the need to destroy his creation as completely as he can. So he cuts it up after determining that it does not have life and breaks it up in acid and then disposes of the sludge, the acidic sludge that results. But interestingly enough, the perspective of the story, the narrator, is the consciousness that he did create in bringing these disparate parts of this creature, the disparate parts of the individuals that made up the creature, I guess I should say, together. He did create or coalesce, at the very least, I suppose, a consciousness, and that is the narrator. So the consciousness understands, it's aware enough to know that it's been cut up, that it's been reduced to a biochemical, I guess, sludge in this acid. The doctor pours it down through the wastewater or sewage system of his castle, and it flows out of his castle. And ultimately, we trace it as it's speaking to us, flowing down off of a mountain, down, 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 until it enters a cemetery, seeps into a particular buried casket, and surrounds and brings that body to life. So it combines with a very decayed body that has been buried in this cemetery, but brings it back to some form of animation, if you want to call that life, and it escapes. It digs its way out and goes back up to visit the doctor. It comes in and it scares the doctor. And yes, here, the third panel on, I don't know, the next to last page, so I guess it'd be page 8 of the story, is the image that we see on the cover, much reduced on the inside than it is on the cover, but there is the image. Covering the mouth of this face is the monster's hand as it's talking to him or attempting to talk to him. All they do is lock eyes, and they communicate via eyes. Now, this whole situation apparently is enough to drive the doctor insane. So he collapses both internally and externally, babbling to himself nonsensically. And the monster just leaves, and he goes up. First panel of the final story page is an awesome-looking panel. It's the monster standing on a bluff, kind of the remnants of a forest where the forest hasn't grown all the way out to the edge of the bluff. So it's kind of spotty trees of a forest. On this bluff, the monster, the creature standing on the bluff, looking over. And there's valley, mountains, forested area, a river running through it. Almost like something that Bob Ross would have painted, you know, something like that. Started with a blank canvas and, oh, here's a little tree, you know. For those of you that have seen Bob Ross, he is one of my favorite entertainers, I'll say. Anyway, the monster looking over, I don't know, I guess it's considering its place in creation, whatever. There's narration all through it, but it's kind of poetic, and I think maybe as you read it, it helps to be in a certain frame of mind to help you understand or acknowledge what it is that is being said. When I read it earlier today, I was fortunately or unfortunately, whichever, in neither, so it kind of flowery language just kind of bounced off my rather thick skull, and it didn't make much of a mark on me. But it's the monster. Yes, I belong and I celebrate, even as the rocks and the trees on this mountaintop celebrate. That's kind of a brief example. But the monster's here. He sits down on the bluff and sits back against the lone tree this close to the edge of the bluff and just sits there. And we have four panels. We have day, we have night, we have winter. Well, I guess we have day, and I guess then we have storm, which is maybe fall. And then we have winter, and then we have a night. And the captions for each are, I belong here, I am accepted for the first. I shall stay here to celebrate the day, to celebrate that which is, for I too have found a home, a purpose forever, as the final panel. And it shows darkness, him sitting here, and I guess what we see is he has sat here unto a skeleton. So he sat here long enough to have degraded to where there's just a skeleton left. If he was preyed upon, it's interesting that he wasn't pulled away and pulled apart, but we just have a skeleton sitting there. Next page, on sale in April, Alien Worlds, in this issue, Aurora by Dave Stevens. This looks to be an issue of Alien Worlds that I've already spoken of. So see one of the previous issues, episodes for Alien Worlds issue 2. That might have been just the last episode of Pacific Tuesday. All right, second story. Scripted, penciled, inked by Bernie Wrightson, colored by Steve Olaf. This is originally from Erie number 58, July 1974. It's a story entitled The Pepper Lake Monster. We're introduced to George Summers. He arrives at Pepper Lake. It's an idyllic little town overlooking an idyllic little lake, except for this sign. It says Pepper Lake, home of the world-famous Pepper Lake Monster, responsible for 82, and it's a movable number there, like days without an accident kind of sign. 82 fatalities, boating at your own risk. And we see George here considering the sign, and he thinks, huh, World famous pepper like monster, eh? We'll see, we'll see. Next panel, Summers was being paid by a large university to investigate claims of sea monsters. Pepper Lake was the last stop on his list. And he has a boat here. It's a sailboat, but it looks like it might also be rigged for a little bit more than just sailing. Maybe to try to capture the monster if it exists, something like that. But he's out. A storm rises, and sure enough, in the midst of the storm, or perhaps having created the storm, we see the Pepper Lake monster. It's a large, serpentine, spiny-backed, scaly creature. Probably the coolest aspect of the monster is the head. It's very dragon-like, and on the top back behind the ears portion of the head, where you would presume there would be ears, behind the eyes, where you would presume there were ears, are big flanges of scale, I guess is what those are. So it gives the head of the monster a very particular, peculiar look. But it surfaces, and Summers is cursing that he has not, that he's too small to do anything, because this monster turns out to be very, very large. And they go back and forth kind of challenging one another, although the sea monster is far big enough that it could easily kill Mr. Summers here. But the storm dies down, and after that we see Summers here saying out loud, "Good Lord, the monster, it was there last night. It was really there." He goes to shore, starts trying to drum up interest in local townies to help him capture the monster. He knows it's real. He's going to bag it. Person after person, different shopkeepers, different individuals. Here's the equivalent of a beach bum sitting here in front of the Pepper Lake sign, actually, with a fishing pole. Nothing. So finally, after exhausting basically all the possibilities of getting help, he's sitting here one night, Mr. Summers is, and he thinks, and no, he's not related as far as I know to Scott Summers. His first name was, did I tell you his first name? George? Yeah, George Summers. I don't know that in Scott Summers' lineage there's ever a George Summers that's come up, so I don't think they're related. If you know, you know. I'm sorry. I hate when people say that. Seems kind of snotty. I was trying to make a joke about Summers. Somebody out there will get it. He's thinking to himself one night, I mean to capture that thing. If I can't get any help from these laconic dolts, laconic, good word, then damn it, I'll do it myself. So now he goes about the little village here, interacting with the people in a different manner. He goes and he buys up several hundred pounds of net, 2 miles of good strong rope, and he's cutting down trees at $25 each tree. And basically he's cutting the trees down and he's making poles out of them, and it's probably 10 to 15 poles at $25 a piece, on top of hundreds of pounds of net and 2 miles of good strong rope. So George here has invested a penny. So we see him rigging something up, nailing the nets to the trees, sinking the trees into the soft bottom mud in the shallows, we're told here by the narrator. And then finally, the frame of reference here backs up for us on one panel. And we see that he has made this like, I don't know, it doesn't necessarily have any geographic shape to it or anything, but it's just he's sunk the poles at different intervals in different places, wrapped the netting around them, and secured the nets with the ropes. And it's just, it looks like this this mess, and I mean mess as in a large number, not as in untidy, but just a mess of netting in the shallows, one portion of the shallows of this lake. Then he picks a clear moonless night and kills half a dozen cows, dismembering the carcasses and streaming them together unto bait, like you would chum for sharks. So he's chumming for sea monster. And he sets the trap, and then he sits on a bluff overlooking the little portion of the shallows of the lake and falls asleep. He hears noises, wakes up, and sees that he has indeed caught this sea monster. It's all caught up and tangled up and everything, and it can't get away. So he goes to the town, and the next morning, all or a sizable portion of the town folk come in to see that George has captured the, or, you know, slash their, being Pepper Lake residents, sea monster. And he starts proclaiming all these things that he and the villagers will be able to do to make money off of the fact that they, George, with the help of the townspeople, have captured the sea monster. And we have several panels of ideas here, an exhibit in a large aquarium, cutting the creature up for science. He's speaking out headlines that could be in local papers or magazines, etc., etc. Then on the final page, we see the twist in the story, of course, being Bernie Wrightson, being a Bruce Jones production. There has to be a twist. And the twist is that the people of Pepper Lake move forward, raised their stones and their clubs, and brought them down upon George Summers again and again, till he lay on the rocky beach and the edge of the lake ran red with his spilled blood. Then they cut the ropes and tore the nets and freed the monster and went back home. Final three panels at the bottom of the page. Shopkeeper here, souvenir shop of some sort. Surely is a shame about that young man. Terrible, terrible. Then at a snack bar on down somewhere. One good thing about it, though. Oh, and we see somebody here at the sign. Anytime there's another death, business picks up as he's taking down the 82 fatalities and is posting 83 fatalities. So, there we go. Nice twisty little story there. I didn't really feel that the first one was kind of a twist, just kind of a straight-up horror-y kind of, maybe more psychological, about the muck monster, Frankenstein-ish returning. All right, next page is a subscribe today to Pacific Comics, highlighting Captain Victory, Silver Star, Grew the Wanderer, Elric of Melnibone, Twisted Tales and Alien Worlds. Next page, Edge of Chaos by Gray Morrow, beginning in May. Well, I'm speaking about June books, and we have yet to speak about Edge of Chaos. I think that might be one of the books that we talk about next time out. It'll be Grew the Wanderer and, let me look, yes, Edge of Chaos, which should be June, July. Should be July of 83, but they're a little late. And it's funny, advertising in the June books for a book that was supposed to have been out in May, and it finally comes out in July. Kind of a head mess up there. All right, our final story. Edgar Allan Poe's The Black Cat. So Edgar Allan Poe is co-credited with the script. Bernie Wrightson. Edgar Allan Poe is credited for original story. Bernie Wrightson for the adaptation. Pencils and inks by Bernie Wrightson. Colors by Steve Olaf. This was originally featured in Creepy issue number 62 from 1974. And this is another kind of, well, it's kind of a straightforward horror story like the first, but it does have a little twist at the very end like the second story, I think. So we are introduced to a husband and wife, no names given, and Pluto. Pluto is their black cat. Pluto takes to the husband, sleeps on his lap all the time, takes to following him when he goes out and about. Eventually, the old man, or not the old man, he's a younger man, but he starts doing and getting into some things that maybe he doesn't want witnessed, and the cat is always there, so it bears witness, and it starts to get on his nerve. Till one day, he just freaks out at the cat, and he smacks it, and in the process of being smacked, the cat bites him. Well, he gets further upset, grabs the cat, and stabs out with a penknife one of its eyes. Yeah. Next several panels, the cat is skulking around and trying to avoid the dude, and the dude is continually trying to abuse, or not trying to, but he's continually abusing the cat. He's kicking it, he terrifies it, he tries to drown it. Ultimately, he hangs it from a tree with a hangman's noose to kill it. Later that night, the house that he and his wife are in burned down, and on the remaining wall, as if carved in bas-relief, was the image of a gigantic cat. Perfect to the tiniest detail, there was a rope around the cat's neck. So, was it real? Was it his conscience? Who's to say? We saw it as the reader, so you would have to say it was really there. Further falls away from being the decent, upstanding man that he was at the very beginning of the story. Lots of bar time, lots of drunkenness. One particular part of the town that he's been frequenting, he finds and befriends a black cat. And when he gets close enough to it one day, he sees that it is missing an eye. Well, this cat starts to take up to him and follow him around as well until the wife notices, right? It's at home there with them. and she notices that it looks exactly like Pluto, but oh, poor thing, it's missing an eye. And, you know, so now the guy starts suspecting, well, dude, is this Pluto come back? We're not sure. One day, my wife asked me to accompany her to the cellar on some errand. Halfway down the stairs, the cat, in walking with me in and out between my legs, caught its tail under my shoe, and in jumping, threw me heavily to the floor. So the dude tumbles and crashes down into the basement. In his anger, he picks up an axe and he's going to kill the cat, but instead he changes the flight of the axe and he buries it. Handle deep in his wife's head. We have a nifty little panel here drawn by Bernie from the front view of the buried axe, and it's rather a gory view. So now Dude Leo doesn't know what to do. So he starts looking around. Finally, he comes upon burying her in the wall. So he finds a wall that has a hollow portion and tears it loose, places her in there, and bricks her back up. Forgets about her, you know, moves on with, well, as messed up as his life is going to be from here on out, having killed his wife with an axe and hidden her in the wall in the basement. So, you know, and I say all that not knowing really what that would be like. I've never managed to get away with, no, I'm kidding. I wouldn't know what that feels like, but this dude is trying to move on. Then people start asking questions. Haven't seen his wife in a while. Absolutely. Introduces some gentlemen to the house one day who are coming in question. Look anywhere you want. She's not here. She's not been here. You know, she was here one day and she was gone the next. I don't know where she went. Looking around. And he's starting to get a crazed look. So it's working on his head. I delight in having allayed your suspicions. I wish you well. By the by, gentlemen, this is a very well-constructed house. I might say an excellently constructed house. These walls, and he's tapping the walls with a cane that he's using. And they hear a scream. Scream came from behind the wall. So the gentlemen go to where approximately they thought they heard the scream down in the basement, and they start tearing the wall down. And sure enough, there is his partly decomposed wife that has been, shows that she is tied up. Now, she was, I think, dead. So I don't know why he would have tied her up, except maybe to move her around a little bit more easily. But the point being, when he walled her up, he walled the cat up with her. And upon being told that somebody was down, you know, in the vicinity by the tapping of the cane on the wall, maybe he tapped it over that very portion of the wall. You couldn't really tell. But the cat-er-walled, shall we say, and gave away the fact that it had been walled up with the wife and he hadn't realized it. So there we go. Moving on. Next story is, or the next book is, Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers. Issue number 11. Looking at the cover here, which came to us penciled by Mr. Kirby, inked by Mike Thibodeau, colored by Janice Cohen, and lettered by Pelle Jensen. A never-to-be-forgotten origin issue in defense of our galaxy, Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers. Read Big Ugly. And interesting combination of aspects of the story inside. On the front cover, we have the character that we're going to know as Big Ugly. He's holding a large mace. Right? Isn't that the handle with the ball and the spikes on the mace? Or is that called something else? Nah, I forget. I'll call it a mace. Standing over a young Captain Victory, hand on shoulder. And the two of them are looking at this conveyor belt to which are attached a series of different heads. And at the end of, well, I take that back. You can't necessarily tell that it's a conveyor belt, I don't think, on the cover. Now, when this shows up in the story, you most certainly know that it's a conveyor belt, and there's a reason why. But it's this long contraption, looks like a conveyor belt, but there's nothing portraying any kind of movement on the cover. That's why I say you can't tell. Heads locked onto it, to where all you see is the heads. You're looking at the heads. At the far end of the conveyor belt is a large saw. Now, what we're going to see in the story is that it's a death device. These people are attached to a moving belt so that their heads are sticking out and this blade is running the length of this contraption, decapitating each one as it comes to them. In the story, that's going to be what happens. Here, you can't really tell all of that other than there's all these heads sticking out of like a little wall here and there's a big blade down there, and that's, you know, that's really all you can tell. Inside front cover, this is issue 11 of our Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers book from Pacific. Inside front cover, Michael Moorcock's Elric of Melniboné number 2 is advertised in the indicia for this issue. Outcast misfits, pariahs, scapegoats. Somewhere along the line, they become what they are. Non-heroes who believe their enemies don't want to kill them. Thus we get Captain Victory and his Galactic Rangers. Yeah, that doesn't really make much sense to me. Meet Big Ugly, and it's Captain Victory walking with his crewman Egghead here. All aliens, enigmas, and other obnoxious residents of Section 51 of the Dreadnought Tiger. Attention! That's Egghead. Two-page spread. We have about 10 or 12 of these really fantastical, weird creatures that Kirby was really into drawing, that are refugees of different planets that have been destroyed that the Dreadnought Tiger took in as, not really as crewmates, but they are crew members. And he's wanting to speak to them. We have a little interaction here with some of the rougher, tougher members of this alien motley crew. And the captain faces them down. And as he's talking to them, he is getting, his facial features are getting more and more grotesque, which is alluding to kind of the captain's origin, which is what this issue's story is going to start telling us. It's going to be a two-book origin story, and this is the first half. So, but we see that the normal-looking, blonde-haired gentleman that has been our captain, as he is getting closer and closer to starting his story, we are seeing that perhaps he is more and more like these, freaks and whatever other words you want to use, these different disparate alien species that he is talking to, than perhaps we, you know, originally have, up to this point, been led to believe. And now, having read that origin story, I can see what Kirby was going for, but I don't necessarily see that crossed the finish line for me. But we go back to when Captain Victory was 8 years old. Yeah, he was an 8-year-old boy. And we're introduced to Big Ugly, who is his cousin. And Big Ugly is a rather interesting creature. He has 3 mouths, 2 eyes, and more horns than you can easily count, really. And he has just come back from a mission of conquest at the behest of the Voice. Now, the way that the Voice is used, it almost seems to me that it is a play on people who are, okay, let's see, how can I say this? That group of Christians that believe that God speaks to them via a disembodied voice and instructs them as to whatever, what they should do, how they should act, answers their questions, you know. But the point is a greater being, a higher being that communicates via a disembodied voice. Now, in Captain Victory, take away everything I said before, disembodied voice, because that's where this concept starts. The allusion is to everything I said prior to that. So they are following the commands of this, of the voice. And they're conquering right and left, everything they can get a hold of, even to the extent a little bit later in this story that they conquer, that the Big Ugly conquers an alien species because they could in the future pose a problem. Not because they're in the way of anything now, but because at some point they could be. So just in this 20 pages, I think is how long this story is, because there's a backup story as well. We see that this group of people that Captain Victory is a part of have conquered everyone that poses a problem and then starts looking at people that could potentially pose a problem and starts conquering them. So at some point, given that philosophy, they will conquer everything, everyone, everywhere. They'll find a reason, but they're not there yet. So we'll back up. Big Ugly has just returned home. Everyone in the family, and I'm using quote marks here, gather because Big Ugly is bringing presents for everyone, which is always what he does when he comes home from a conquest tour, let's call it. We're introduced to a couple more characters here, Brother Pius and Father Black Mass. There is further a woman here. This is a full page panel that has those two characters and a third female character who is unnamed. And in the previous panel, as the 8-year-old Captain Victory shows up, there is another female that shows up that I suspect, because of the way she's dressed, is part of the family. We have Big Ugly, and then we have the a woman who is dressed more like a matronly mother or a high nun, kind of, that's the feeling, governess over Captain Victory, again, as he's only 8 years old. Now, the present that Big Ugly has brought for Captain Victory turns out to be King Zerid, who is the king over one of the planets that they just conquered. So Captain Victory, the young Captain Victory, or whatever his name is, Felonius, or I don't know, they don't give him a name here. But the young Captain Victory speaks to the captive, but then is interrupted before anything of really any merit, importance can be said to the young one to expose him to a different thought, a different philosophy. Before that can happen, Big Ugly steps up and drops a compressed air pill into the mouth of King Zerid, and using titanium tape, tapes his mouth shut. Ultimately, what happens is that the canister of compressed air releases its contents, and King Zerid blows up like a balloon until he finally pops. The point, I believe, of this portion of the story was to show that at this time, Captain Victory is not affected by this scene. Everyone else backs away because the, you know, explosion is going to be this horrendous thing, or they back away to not be covered in blown up king goo, or, you know, whatever. They have more what you would presume is a normal reaction to this rather outrageous situation. Whereas on top of the outrageosity, is that a word? I don't know. Because of the outrageousness of the situation, Captain Victory's lack of behavior is just as or more outrageous than the situation. He does not act like everyone else. So we see that my thought is that we see the young man is well on his way to being the uncreator that he is being brought up to be. And he is definitely showing signs of not being bothered by massive uncreation, if that makes sense. Next up is Captain Victory at 15. He is now a tactician on Big Ugly's mothership. And there's a scene here where the planet of the Aqua people has been conquered, and the royal family has been brought up to the ship, and they are here in a big pool and are just gunned down. The pool is just surrounded by soldiers with weapons, and they're all just, the royal family's just obliterated. Why? Well, because it must, to complete the conquest. But Big Ugly again did this because he's a he thrives in the chaos, it seems, that death causes, rather the death itself or the chaos caused by the death of particular individuals, the chaos in the rest of their family or in society, if it's rulers of the planet, or, you know, however you want to measure it. But the chaos that comes with death seems to be what Big Ugly thrives in. The next scene is Captain Victory talking to Brother Pius. Now, he references, in mercy's name, brother, you must counsel this maniac, speaking of Big Ugly. So, in mercy's name, brother, you must counsel. So, it's in mercy's name, comma, brother, you must counsel this. But the name of the character is Brother Pius. So, I can't tell if it is familial brother or title brother that Captain Victory is using here. Could be that it's his familial brother. Don't really know. Maybe it really doesn't matter. It's just, it was thrown in there for a reason. And because of that, I try to decipher the reason, you know, to see if like someone like, say, James Tiny in the Fourth, who throws things out all the time, but they are not dismissible things. They always come back. Whereas other writers, you know, that we've known in comic books, they throw stuff out and they never get back to it, probably never intend to. Or you have somebody like, say, Chris Claremont, who throws stuff out there, never intends to get back to it, but then 40 years later gets back to it. Yeah, so I don't know. But I'm not sure. Brother Pius is his name, so we'll just go with the title Brother, because it's easiest to figure out, because it's right there in our face. So Captain Victory is starting to, even though his reaction to the king's being blown up like a balloon, that was, well, although I must say that was 7 or 8 years later, prior to where we are now. So Captain Victory has seen and experienced these kind of things for the last 7 or 8 years, definitely, that we know of. And ultimately, he is beginning to tire of it. He goes to Brother Pius and is seeking help with Big Ugly. None there. Brother Pius is much more on Big Ugly's side than he is on Captain Victory's. And thinking about it, you'll have to pardon me if I kind of hesitate saying Big Ugly. There is actually a town in southern West Virginia called Big Ugly, and there's a joke attached to it about a news article, or anytime news comes out of Big Ugly talking about a big ugly woman or a big ugly man, or, you know, it, yeah. So, but there is actually a town in southern West Virginia that's where I'm at, called Big Ugly. So whenever I get ready to say that, I wait a minute to, you know, I'm used to it being a joke, and it's like, no, it's not a joke here. It's actually the character's name. So I have to keep riding that particular train, instead of the years of knowing that Big Ugly is actually the name of a town near where I'm at. Anyways, sorry, back to Captain Victory. A little bit too much about me. Sorry. He walks into this big Kirby contraption-filled room, a big computer, in essence a 1983 model AI is what he's talking to. And the name is Turai, T-U-R-A-I. At least that's how I'm going to say it, Turai. And the AI, though, is part of the ship that Big Ugly commands. So I don't know if Captain Victory is doing anything more than utilizing this AI at this point. I don't think he has, like, created it or freed it from something or anything like that. It's just an aspect of the ship that he's on, and the ship is controlled by Big Ugly. I say that because Captain Victory is looking for assistance against Big Ugly, speaking to this AI that is on the ship that Big Ugly commands. So the AI is genuinely torn about what to do. It logically agrees with what Captain Victory poses to it, but it knows the reality of the fact that it is part of Big Ugly's command component. The next chapter, we'll say, of the story is the chapter that utilizes this contraption that holds everyone. Now we see they're on their hands and knees, tied up, the hands behind the back, bent over, kind of like a stock, like you're put in stocks, except, you know, normally your hands are out there beside your head. Here, the hands are tied behind their back, but they're put in much the same position as you are with the stock. Dozens of people side by side, and at the end of this contraption is a large blade, like a saw blade, that's now going to sweep through the length of this contraption, just lopping off the heads as it encounters them. So Big Ugly sends this contraption craning down through here, and we now see Captain Victory verbally objecting to what's going on, trying to stop Big Ugly from doing this, but to no avail. Again, this is what Big Ugly does in the name of the voice, but I mean, Big Ugly derives much more pleasure, I don't know, satisfaction from doing it, as well as the fact that he has been commanded to do it, and he is able to do as he has been commanded. So he gets whatever positive vibes from that, warm fuzzies, as the kids used to say. Next up, we are on the planet Valerian, or actually we are in orbit around the planet Valerian. Big Ugly is just destroying this civilization, and this is the civilization that I indicated to earlier that Big Ugly destroys, because at some point it could become an impediment to what the voice wants done. So Big Ugly is kind of jumping ahead and taking care of this now before it becomes an issue. Well, that is it. Captain Victory jumps up in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 panels, each panel firing a shot into Big Ugly. And he's bending over him as he says, "You're basically a boar, Big Ugly. A large, organized mess of protein. I know how to kill now. I'm a soldier. I'm a soldier." So he has just killed Big Ugly. I guess to assume command is what's going to happen. We'll see next issue. We're told watch for it. Origin 2, end of the boy, beginning of the man. Next page is a subscription advert for, yeah, the same six or seven books that they've been adverting you subscribe to. Interestingly enough, let's see. All of them are 1 year for six issues, and they vary anywhere from $5.50 to $9. Three of them are $5.50, three of them are $9. So I would say the nines are, yeah, anthology books or books where they have to pay a lot more money for the rights, because one of them is Elric of Melniboné. And the three $5.50 for six-issue books are books that Pacific has created and is selling. All right, the next page is a full-page advert for somebody's portfolio. And because of the very poor coloring on the page, you can't see who it is. But it turns out that it is for Layla Dowling for her Dragons 2 portfolio. $20. It's going to be limited to 3,000 sets. Each print is 11.5 by 16, but nowhere does it tell us how many prints are in each portfolio. Well, I tracked down Miss Dowling's art to the Northern Star Art Inc. website, and we are told that, well, here they have, okay, she has had four portfolios. This is Dragons 2. Now, of course, you can assume there was a Dragons 1, yes, and there was also a Unicorns 1 and 2, but Unicorns 1 and 2 and Dragons 1, I don't believe has been put out by Pacific, but they did get the rights to distribute Dragons 2. Now, I tracked down on the Northern Star Art Inc. resell page the portfolio. This is Unicorns 1 and 2 that I'm looking at. They also have a set of the Dragons 1 and 2. Six plates. So each of these for the Unicorns 1 and 2 is six plates. So that's 12 plates, 11 by 16 in a folder that is 11.5 by 16.5. Ah, they were published by Shanes and Shanes, which is a publishing branch of Pacific. So apparently they have published all four of these portfolios. $125 now for 12 panels, 11 by 16, of Miss Layla Dowling's art involving unicorns. And actually, the price is the same for the two dragons. So, Layla Dowling, L-E-L-A-D-O-W-L-I-N-G. I've never heard of this individual before seeing this ad and looking this up. So, that was cool. Off on a Comet is our next story, and it is scripted, penciled, inked, colored, and lettered by Tim Conrad. So, this is a second story that is in the Captain Victory book. Captain Victory was 20 pages. This is 10. And we are introduced to Ernest Bigby, Lindsay Krannert, and Dr. Mallory Simpson. They're all on board this vessel that is to land, take samples, and bring back samples of a comet. And a cool-looking ship. It's a perfect sphere, but yet when it lands, it becomes half a sphere with these teeth interspersed between the jets that allow it to ascend and descend onto the comet. And it sinks down, and that's how it holds onto the comet as it's speeding on its journey, allowing the ship to stay where it is so that they can EVA and go get samples. So they do land, and let's see. It is Lindsay that stays inside while Ernst and Dr. Simpson go EVA. So they're doing the different things to get different samples, and Dr. Simpson continues looking around and goes to the edge of this bluff and looks down to the surface of the comet below the bluff there, and he sees that it is a greenish something, and that it is covered and uncovered like the wind would be blowing snow across it or off of it. And so it appears to be this greenish floor, let's say, or something flat, extensively in the area, flat. But it has writing of some sort on it as well that is partially obscured, again, because it's covered and uncovered in sections. But the three panels are, from top to bottom, increasing in size. So you have, like, say, a panel that is just for reference one, then the second panel is like 1 3/4, and then the third panel is like 2, 2.5 as far as vertical size, let's say. And first you see the doctor stepping onto it. It's greenish and you see these raised portions on either side of his feet. And then it backs up a little bit and you see a further portion of it that is cleared off with him standing on the edge of it. And it looks like this might be maybe writing that is exposed or something like that. And then the third panel backs off enough that you can see, yes, it's several lines of very large lettering. The letters are perhaps 3 to 4 feet from top to bottom, and there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 exposed rows, covered and uncovered by the frost, the snow, the ice, whatever that is the comet. And after this finding, they go back to the ship. We see that further study has been done by the instrumentation on the ship to try to discern what this is that they're looking at. And the ship indicates that it's a cube that is 100 meters on a side, and that there are glyphs on it that correspond to an ancient Babylonian script. So this is all cool and everything, but, you know, time is running out. They can only be on the comet for a limited period of time for several different reasons. The comet is constantly moving away from them getting home. There is only so much energy that they have to power the ship itself, to power the ship to get home, to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. All of the typical things that you encounter in space voyages. You know, everything is time. There's a time limit for everything because we are frail sacks of water and we need a lot of work to keep going. So, you know, the captain is like, okay, well, this is cool. We'll send somebody back when the comet circles back around to get, you know, to get more information. And the doctor's like, well, wait, that means, and, you know, he calculates in his head real quick, and it's like, that's another 75 years. And the captain, who is Lindsay Krannert, she's like, okay, good job. Everybody strap in. We need to go. And so she's, you know, constantly, come on, we need to go. We need to finish up, gather up, strap in, you know, whatever, whatever. Bigby is like, whatever. He's being the good soldier, you know. Whereas Dr. Simpson is like, oh no, we can't go. We have to, you know, discover as much about this as we can. And the captain is telling him, well, we have discovered as much as we can because we have to go. And so finally, it looks like this artifact or something in the artifact or somehow, but Dr. Mallory and this artifact make a connection to where the artifact either is speaking through the doctor or it has inhabited the doctor. But now the doctor starts objecting in an entirely different manner with nasty, mean-looking green eyeballs. At one point, with some sort of energy eruption, he reaches out and seemingly kills Bigsby. And so now he's trying to stop the captain, who she is trying to take off to save who she can. She also thinks that maybe if they get far enough away from whatever this thing is that they found, it'll revert the doctor back to himself. So she backs up and backs up and just backs up towards the control console. And just as the inhabited Mallory is reaching out green nimbus-y energy towards her, she reaches a self-destruct button and sets it off. The ship and the comet that it's on blows up much unto the Death Star does in the redone versions of Star Wars, you know, with the vertical and horizontal big circles of energy that emanate away from the Death Star in that next version where they added more special effects. Well, that's kind of how the comet is drawn blowing up here. And left in the comet's orbit is the taken over Dr. Mallory, who we are left to believe is still something. I don't know if it's still alive, or he definitely is still in one piece, because we do see that physically, that he remains whole. Everything else seemingly has been destroyed, which I take it also means whatever the green thing was, whether it was a portion of the comet or the entire comet or whatever, it's gone. But in its place is this inhabited human that now will float around in space in the same orbit as this comet. And so this is the end of that story. And thus is the end of File 1 of the June 83 Pacific coverage. Come back in a minute to listen to the next. Bye-bye.